Welcome to A Touch of Gray. My name is Vicki Duke, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster, bringing to you the literature of AARP, both the bulletin and the magazine. And I'm coming to you from member-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona. Starting with In the News Special Report, we are in the bulletin. High stakes in state and local races, from governor's races to control of Congress to the way we vote. Key races lurk down the ballot. By Chris Adams. Democracy is on the ballot this fall, literally. It's happening in Alaska and Arizona, California and Connecticut, Idaho and Iowa, and plenty of other states. In fact, whatever their views on the rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, voters in this year's election in those states and others will have a chance to weigh in on how future elections will be held. In many ways, this cycle is a continuation of the 2022 midterm elections, when the normally sleepy office of Secretary of State, generally the people who run elections, became one of the year's hottest tickets. There are fewer of those races this year, but more ballot measures that touch on the democratic process. For voters, it's another reminder that for all the attention the top of the ticket gets, much of their world is governed by what's happening down ballot. A lot of the things that get decided at the federal level really are so distanced from the everyday of people's lives, says Bill Sweeney, AARP Senior Vice President for Government Affairs. But the state-level elections are the ones that really have a huge, huge impact, especially in the space that we work in at AARP. That means issues such as boosting health care and long-term care access, increasing support for family caregivers, expanding platforms for retirement savings, and corralling prescription drug costs. While federal policies play a role in these issues, it's often governors and state legislatures that implement them. Beyond that, state-level officials play a dominant role in some of the hot-button issues of our era, including abortion access, the voting process, education policy, and gun rights. In all, there will be 11 state governor races on the ballot, including high-profile ones in North Carolina and New Hampshire. Two territories elect governors as well. Also, on statewide ballots will be 7 secretaries of state and 10 attorneys general. In the U.S. Senate, 34 seats are up, and in the House, all of them are. Included are several House races in districts with new boundaries since the 2022 election. And in state houses around the country, nearly 5,800 legislative seats will be decided. Two worlds apart. All of this is happening as the country is both evenly divided and drifting apart. Preference for Democrats and Republicans is virtually even among registered voters, 49% to 48%, narrower than in any of the past 7 presidential election years, according to the Pew Research Center. Democrats and their allies have a 2-seat edge in the Senate. Republicans hold a 5-seat advantage in the House. Among governors, Republicans have 4-seat edge when considering the 50 states, but throw in the American territories and it's dead even. 27 each, plus one independent, according to the National Governors Association. Pretty tight. At the same time, Americans' views about the country, where it's heading and what to do about it, are drifting farther apart. Over the past 2 decades, data from Gallup finds that on a range of issues, such as the role of government power, education, abortion, gun laws, health care, the gaps between right and left have widened. And if you look at whom Americans send to Congress, researchers who track every vote by every member have found that average Republican and the average Democrat are as far apart as they have been in nearly 150 years. However you define it, says Sarah Binder, a political science professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., polarization is on the rise. When they pull that lever, drop that envelope, or punch that ballot, American voters will have a chance to tip the scales between these two political parties and the divergent worldviews they represent. A lot of the country is on a knife's edge between the two parties, Sweeney said. Choosing how to choose. It's not just politicians voters will decide on. It's also the political process itself. It's important for people to be prepared and know what's on their ballot before they get there, says Michael Lee, senior counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program, which is part of NYU Law. Among the issues at play, ranked choice voting. In 4 states, Nevada, Oregon, Alaska, and Missouri, voters will address ranked choice voting. In the first 2, voters will decide whether to adopt a ranked choice system, while Alaska voters will be asked if they want to ditch theirs. Missouri's measure would prohibit it in the state. That's as of press time. The Alaska ballot measure is the subject of litigation. Colorado, Idaho, and the District of Columbia may have ranked choice on their ballots, too. Under one form of ranked choice voting, all candidates, Republican, Democratic, other, run in the same primary, and the top vote getters face off in the general election when people rank their favorites. It's intended to reduce polarization by favoring candidates who appeal to people on both sides of the aisle. Ranked choice voting is responding to the frustration with the current political process and the lack of choice, said Larry Jacobs, director for the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. The idea is to put pressure on candidates to be less extreme. According to Fair Vote, a nonprofit advocating for this system, 50 jurisdictions, 2 states, 3 countries, 45 cities by early 2024 were using a form of ranked choice voting. No excuse absentee voting. Voters in Connecticut will have a chance to vote on whether the General Assembly can enact no excuse absentee voting, which would allow any voter to request a mail-in ballot without having to meet requirements such as declaring they are sick or going to be out of town. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 28 states offer such voting, and 8 other states and the District of Columbia conduct elections entirely by mail. Non-citizen voting. As of June, half a dozen states have initiatives on the November ballot that, if passed, would declare that non-citizens can't vote in elections in the state. Except in some municipal elections, non-citizens already can't vote. But in Idaho, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, and Wisconsin this fall, voters will be asked to confirm that the already illegal act is illegal. In the eyes of Charlie Cook, founder of the nonpartisan Cook Political Report and a leading elections analyst, some ballot measures are less about the issue at hand than the effect they will have on the voters. A lot of the ballot initiatives now are sort of tools for parties to do things to jack up their turnout. On the right, that can mean measures on taxes or the voting process. On the left, it can mean abortion-related measures, which will be on the ballot in several states in November. Among other election-related ballot measures is one in Arizona that would enshrine in the state constitution that partisan primaries be used for elections if the office is a partisan one. That's already the state's practice, but the amendment would make it harder to change the system down the road. And in California, voters will be asked to decide whether certain ballot measures would need to meet higher thresholds to pass. The growing number of ballot measures likely will grow throughout the summer. As of mid-June, there were 101. Presidential election years back to 2004 have averaged more than 150 by election day. Legislative balance. Control of state governments is also at play, with the vast majority of state House seats and a majority of state Senate seats up for grabs. Along with the governors, those lawmakers will have a role in deciding the issues, such as family caregiving, Social Security taxation, retirement savings options, high-speed internet access, and Medicaid expansion that could make people's lives just a bit easier. Nancy LeMond, AARP Executive Vice President and Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer, has been particularly struck by people's retirement worries. This notion of being able to save so that you're not poor when you're older and when you retire has gotten even more prominent, she says. State houses aren't as close as Congress. Republicans control 28, Democrats 20. One is divided and one is nonpartisan. In 8 states, one party has the governor's mansion, the other both houses. And a couple of big state legislatures, Michigan and Pennsylvania, are right on that knife's edge. Because older voters turn out in greater numbers than their younger counterparts, they'll have a disproportionate impact on what should be an exceedingly close election year. When everything is this close, everything really matters, says Keelan Batia, AARP Voter Engagement Director. And again, this article is by Chris Adams, who is the Director of State News for the AARP Bulletin. The next article is in the Your Life section. America's best athletes are set to compete at the Summer Olympics in Paris. To win a medal, each one needs a supportive coach, someone with the experience and wisdom to help them achieve success. These five Team USA head coaches share their advice for coaching at any level, from your own team to your kids' or grandkids' teams. First, we have Gary Sutton. At 69, he's women's endurance track cycling coach. Background: competed for Australia at the 1976 and 1980 Olympics. Was the amateur world points race champion in 1980. Has more than 30 years of experience as a cycling coach. His journey: I just dreamt about going to the Olympics. When I finally did, I was presented with my national uniform, and the first night I slept in my shirt. When I retired from competition, my old coach asked if I would like to try coaching. My vision was to open up a coffee shop and do something with my wife. Anyway, I started coaching, and it was full of challenges, and I've always loved a challenge. It would be fair to say that I make most of my best decisions when I'm riding my bike. It's such a beautiful feeling, the wind on my face. I don't answer the mobile phone. I don't answer messages. It's my own space. I learned from a coaching perspective, you need to give yourself a good 1 hour a day of your own time to yourself or to your family or to your wife. His coaching philosophy: every athlete is different. I think if you can challenge an athlete, get them to do something that they believe they could never achieve, it's a turning point for the athlete and for the coach. Getting the best out of the athlete is a wonderful thing. Next, we have Steve Kerr, who's 58, men's basketball. Background: five-time NBA champion as a player, four-time NBA champion as a coach with the Golden State Warriors. His journey: I was 6 or 7 years old and I went to a UCLA game. They were in their heyday and I just fell in love with it, all of it. The gym, the team, the crowd. I went to a John Wooden youth basketball camp, and the former UCLA coach was a legend. That's when I started learning about the game, and I knew I wanted to play basketball. In the back of my mind, I always knew I would be a coach one day. I grew up in a family of teachers. Coaching and teaching are the same, so it came naturally for me. I waited until my kids were grown because of how demanding coaching can be. I just missed a chance to play on the 1988 Olympic team. I made it to the last cut. Now, being able to coach the team, it's amazing. I wish I could still play, but my knees won't let me. His coaching philosophy: at this level, I coach the most talented players in the world, but even they have to know that you're going to help them reach their goals and dreams. Then they will respect you. Players just want you to be supportive, even in pro basketball. That's the most important thing. You can be demanding, but you have to be supportive. Next, we have Mike Gatone, 60. Weightlifting. Background: has worked as a weightlifting coach for more than 30 years, senior director of sport performance for USA Weightlifting. His journey: I realized early on that I was a strong kid, but I wouldn't be an Olympian. So I wondered how I could make weightlifting a big part of my life. That's where coaching came in. My mom was a teacher. I studied physical education. I knew that teaching and coaching was going to be an avocation for me. As I age, I read a lot about folks spending more time alone, especially when they're not working. I'm thankful to be coaching and be around these young kids who are fun. It's nice for me as a coach to be in a social group. His coaching philosophy. I love the relationships that coaching builds. I'm a pretty outgoing person, so it all fits in naturally for me. The first thing as a coach is to find that kind of unique, intrinsically motivated person who says, "This is my thing, and I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to go through the grind and do this." That's the first thing I look for. Home support is a big deal. Even these Olympic level athletes, although they are paid a monthly stipend, a lot of times they live at home, train in a garage or a CrossFit gym. You have to have a social support network and find your joy. I try to make practices for my athletes fun by doing different challenges. For anybody, if you want to be good at something, you have to find joy in the process. Whatever makes you tick and makes you want to keep putting in the time. Next, LaTanya Sheffield, 60, women's track and field. Background: hurdler at San Diego State University and at the 1988 Olympics, coach at Long Beach State University. Her journey. Coaching was just like my whole track and field career. It found me. In high school, I was a cheerleader. I hung out with the cheerleaders. Then all of my friends went to track, so I was like, okay, let's go. Then my brother suggested I try out for the track team at San Diego State, and I made the Olympic team. You never know where life is going to take you. I started to coach because of my daughters who were in school. I just wanted to help out. I didn't want to be the Olympian parent. Her coaching philosophy. I'm not a perfect coach, but during my journey from all levels, from youth athletics to high school athletics to collegiate athletics to world-class athletics, communication has been key. When I say communication, I mean from the receiver as well as the giver. You're listening. But share all of the life lessons and wisdoms that you have. It's so powerful. You've been there and you've seen it before. Tell them you don't want emotions to overtake the fundamentals to execute the task. You have to be able to maintain that emotion, your heart racing, so that you can perform when they say, "On your marks." Athletes need to learn to be more on the even keel, not have the highest highs or the lowest lows in the trenches of competition. Anthony Nesty at 56, men's swimming. Olympic gold medal winner in 1988 for Suriname. Bronze medalist in 1992. Coach at the University of Florida. His journey. My dad wanted me to do an individual sport. He thought of the discipline aspect. Individual sports are all about you and how much work you're willing to put in to get the results. You have no one to blame if things don't go right but yourself. When I graduated college, my dad said, "Son, you're on your own." All I knew was swimming. I started coaching 5 days a week at my high school. I really started enjoying it, seeing the joy on the kids' faces when they make improvements. Now I'm starting my 27th season as a coach at Florida. His coaching philosophy: coaches have to bring the juice or it's going to be a long 2-hour training. Kids look up to you, and if you bring the energy on a day-to-day basis, they are going to bring energy too. There is a lot of competition at practice. I deal with 60 to 70 athletes. I know not everyone is going to get along, but they must respect each other. Everyone sees the good our athletes are capable of because they see them at their best. But it's a roller coaster getting there. Such is life. But as coaches, the athletes make us look better than we actually are. And that article is by Kevin Spain, who is a sports journalist who formerly worked for USA Today. Well, that's the end of our show. Again, my name is Vicki Duke, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster coming to you from member-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.